Welcome back to the Physio Matters podcast. This month, in association with exerciseprescriber.com, and this is session 66. Hello and welcome back to the Physio Matters podcast. My name's Jack March and this month we've got a brilliant interview that I recorded live with Anna Boniface at the COPA show. Before we head on to talking a bit about the podcast, you might have to bear with me a little bit as we've got a lot of news to get through. So give me 2 minutes and we'll crack through that as quickly as we can. Session 65 with Chris Mercer was just brilliant. It's had some really, really good reviews with people saying absolutely tons of clinically applicable information. Following that, we managed to find Graham Wilkes again at the COPA show, and he recorded a 15-minute response with regards to a couple little bits which he not necessarily disagreed with, but just wanted to add some nuance to. So well worth checking that out. Head over to Facebook. You'll find the video of that there. If we find a gap in our recording schedule, we might well be able to put that out as a little audio clip as well. So keep an eye out for that. Well, in between our last record, we also had our first Patient Matters podcast with Sam Williams. Again, brilliant, brilliant response to this podcast and really useful for clinicians and patients alike with regards to someone's journey with chronic pain. You can check that out again on the feed, or if you head to the Facebook page, again, there's the entire video of that recording. Really worth checking out. You can also find the recording of Adrian McGregor's Patient Matters, which will go out in a few weeks' time on this feed. He was discussing how pain affects your mental health as it was recorded during Mental Health Week. Another brilliant record and really worth checking out. Finally, a week ago, we released Natters 2.3. The two Jacks discussed the hashtag Big R's program, which dropped a few days before. Discussed that through in quite a lot of detail. So again, check it out for any information that you want there. And then head to reform.physio/conference for your ticket info, the full program and the speaker bios if you've not seen that as yet. The tickets are selling nice and quickly, so you better get in there to avoid disappointment. Don't forget you can support the show and receive bonus stuff if you head to choosehealth.co.uk/support. Send us a few quid and that'll help us keep making all this content. We're almost weekly now putting things out onto the feed. So if you're keen on that continuing, then unfortunately we do need a few pennies to help us along the way. And you can get some bonus content and extra stuff for doing it in that fashion. So finally, on to this week's podcast. I was absolutely blown away by the quality of this podcast with Anna. We talk about relative energy deficiency in sport in a lot of depth, covering every aspect of the condition, and there's certainly something in there for every clinician. Whether you work a lot with elite athletes or just athletes in general, there's certainly something there. It's changed my practice almost immediately, and I've put a lot of the information from Anna straight away into my assessments and management. So I will leave you to that without further ado, and I'll see you on the other side. Well, hello everybody. My name's Jack March. I'm absolutely delighted to be here for session 66 of Physio Matters. We're at the COPA show. We're live. It won't be live to you guys. Obviously, you'll be listening to this in a couple of weeks' time when we release it. But I am really happy to have Anna Boniface here with me. We're going to be talking all about relative energy deficiency in sport. And I'm sure I'm going to mess that up a little bit later, so we will try to keep that to a minimum. Hopefully we're happy to use REDS. Is that a good shortening for us, Anna?
Yeah, I think it's quite commonly known as REDS or Red S.
Red S.
Yep.
Lovely, great. I think it might make it a little bit easier for me to not mess up my pronunciation. It's the middle E that always gets me, and I'm not sure quite why that is. But hopefully we can have a really good conversation over the next sort of 45 minutes and get to grips with something that I think, from my eyes, is a little bit sort of a relatively newer
phenomenon within sort of the physiotherapy realm for certain, but something I think I've come across more recently and we need to delve into some depth about, really, to help us as clinicians to understand how to assess people, et cetera, and what to do afterwards, really. But before we get cracking, do you want to give us a little bit of an introduction to yourself, where how your career's gone so far, how you got into REDS specifically, and then we can crack on from there?
Yeah, so I graduated from Brunel University in 2013, and I had pretty much of a classic physio upbringing. NHS junior rotations at Norfolk Park and Central Middlesex Hospital. And actually, I spent the majority of my career specialising in respiratory physio and did all my acute sort of respiratory, and then decided that with my athletic career, I'd be better suited to doing a bit more chronic disease in the community, moved to St Mary's in Paddington, and then decided to start to delve into musculoskeletal alongside a bit of chronic disease management with COPD. So currently I spend less time doing sputum catching and more time working at a police rehabilitation unit called Flint House, which is based in Goring-on-Thames in Oxfordshire. So that is intensive rehab for injured police officers in the South and Midlands and South Wales. So it's an incredible place to work.
Yeah, I can imagine that's really rewarding.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about the athletics then, because I think, especially as we go on with this discussion, I think that's going to become really, really relevant. So tell us a little bit about your background with athletics and where you're at the moment, if you don't mind.
Yeah, of course. So I was very much of a middle-of-the-pack runner for a huge amount of time of my running career. 2012, the Olympic year, I remember coming 293rd in the National Cross Country Championship. But I very much had this strong desire to be doing better in my running. I knew I could run better. And I started to run a little bit more distance, started to do a couple of half marathons. And it wasn't until about 2015 that I started to have some improvements, which very much coincided with how much I was running. So I upped my mileage and got quite a quick correlation with running quicker. I then decided that I'd do the London Marathon. I quite naively debuted round in 2016 at London in 2:45, high-fiving my way around the crowd. And I thought, oh, actually, the marathon's probably what I'm going to be best at. So decided to train a little bit more specifically for it. And the following year in 2017 at London, I ran 2:37. I won the mass participation race, the first non-elite female athlete. And all my dreams came true. I got selected to run for England. I got sponsored by Saucony. Just everything happened what I'd ever sort of dreamed of. And all those sort of ambitions I had just happened. But unfortunately, my quite a lot of years of behaviours, which we'll talk about, then caught up with me. So unfortunately, on my England debut, I actually got a stress fracture in the race. Yeah. And I couldn't finish my international debut. So I say that it was the breakthrough that broke me. And this is why I've developed quite an interest in REDS, is through my own personal experience and journey through that.
Yeah. And we'll come on to this a bit later, but obviously, you said you upped the mileage. Were there other things that you feel like you saw that improvement? Do you feel like it was purely related to the mileage? Did you change any other behaviours at that time? Or do you think that you stayed with your historical behaviours but with an elevated mileage?
I certainly think that my behaviours had already been quite well grounded by that point. But you look at the athletes you inspire to be, and they're all running 100 miles a week. And yeah, you think, that's what I need to do to be a good marathon runner. I became a lot more obsessive over mileage and minute per mile and pace. And I was already having some issues, I would say, with eating, but I'd never heard of the concept of waist weight. And I remember it was never directed at me, but I overheard a coach saying, oh, you know you're going to run fast when your mum says you look ill. So I thought, oh, if you're going to be really skinny and lean, you're going to run faster. So this concept of race weight started to happen as well. Right. So I would be actively trying to lose weight to be at my kind of greyhound for a peak race. And unfortunately, when you're doing that, you then push those boundaries even more. So you think, I don't want to put on weight again.
Yeah.
So that weight loss sort of escalates more, and you keep trying to push that each time, where it should be a little, well, you shouldn't have the concept of race weight, but it should be more periodized.
Yeah. Yeah. Fair enough. And I suppose, you know, I'm not a runner. I do a bit of cycling. I wouldn't even say I'm really an athlete of any kind, really. And, you know, I can understand the concept of you see it in all the sports, of people peaking at the right time and all this kind of thing. And you know, if you take a sport like, I recently watched the golf, the Masters was on, and they were talking about some of the golfers would try and peak their technique for that specific competition, which is fine and really hard to do. The same thing, I assume, happens with the runners, but the problem that you're going to come up against is, you know, if you allow some rest time, for example, or you, like you said, you allow your habits of eating or something to lapse, for want of a better term, then the weight gain is probably much easier than the weight loss to keep that even and not drop into a poorer health behavior. And I assume those endurance sports are more prone to what we're going to talk about in a minute than the non-endurance sports. So, like, you know, we'll probably come onto this again, but, you know, footballers, for example, will run a lot, but you don't really see, as you said, that sort of physique alteration like you do in the endurance athletes. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think endurance sport, there is this culture of being... an incorrect culture, I might add, of being lean and increasing your performance through being this sort of race weight. And, you know, other sports that are at risk of, you know, is your aesthetic sports. Things like dancing as well, when it's easier when you're on point to be lighter. You know, rock climbing, you're going against gravity, therefore being lighter should be easier. But it's that sort of, that fine line of when being lean and actually has detriment to your performance.
Yeah. And it makes logical sense, doesn't it? If you've got to run 26 and a half miles, if you weigh 9 stone versus 8 stone, logic dictates that 8 stone's going to be easier to run around that distance, doesn't it, I suppose?
Yeah, I suppose it does, but there is that sort of point where there's other factors that will make your performance better rather than losing weight. And then, you know, losing weight actually becomes detriment to performance.
Yeah,
and
for sure.
You should be looking at other things to improve your performance and not using that as your go-to. You know, for cycling, for example, you know, you do have to have some extent of having the correct body type. But instead of striving to lose weight, you know, why don't you look at being more aerodynamic? Why don't you look at, you know, changing your fitness, changing your diet to make you perform better, etc.
Yeah.
So there's other go-to areas. And I think weight loss is often almost a shortcut to success because it's quite a quick response. So, I do think it's a bit of a shortcut for a quick improvement.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And so to finish your story off then, so you obviously, as you said, you had your debut and you suffered the stress fracture during that. What happened sort of after that?
So I consequently got diagnosed with Red S. I found out that I had osteopenia. Mm-hmm. I had 8 years of amenorrhea leading up to that. And people go to me as a physio, how did you not know? But you just think it won't happen to you. And, you know, I know about physiology. I knew what I was doing was not great.
Yeah.
But I had never had a stress fracture. I wasn't really getting injured. And I was on this 2 years of every time I ran, I was running quicker. And I was caught into this success, continuous success and continuous weight loss and running better. And you just get caught up in that. And then this is very classic with a lot of athletes, is that they tend to be performing very, very well. And all of a sudden, it all just comes crashing down on them.
Yeah.
So that is exactly what happened to me. And I was managed by a sports medicine doctor, referred to a dietitian. And then I didn't run for about 6 months. I was put onto hormone replacement therapy to protect my bones and to try and kickstart my periods, but mainly for bone protection.
Mm-hmm.
And from my own sort of reading and looking at some of the evidence-based things with bone health, doing a lot of strength and conditioning and plyometric work to improve my bone density, as that was really important to me. then did the classic graded return to running, and I then started running again and had a very quick getting back to running, actually competing. It took a year to the day I was out, and I did my first cross country back a year to the day of when pretty much I got injured, and I was having some quite good performances. But then again, the problems that I've had from relative energy deficiency in sport has still been biting me kind of in the backside. And it, I think it's just really important to note that the progress is not linear.
Yeah.
And at one minute you do feel that you're getting back to it, and then the next there's other issues from what I've been doing for many years is still catching up on me.
Yeah, because I suppose you, from an outsider looking in, you obviously suffered what could be termed sort of more, I know it's a stress reaction, but it's more of an acute problem that you've suffered. But then that build up over the time is then going to come out later as well, once, like you said, once you start trying to get back into the training.
Yeah, I think your body just at one point just says, enough is enough. I need a break from this. So if it's not, you know, a bony injury, it's like a tendon injury. We know that hormones affect your tendon health, and if it's not that, it's gastrointestinal problems. If it's not that, it's low iron. I think this is how REDS has evolved, is the fact that it affects multiple systems, and it's not just primarily the bone health, which it's more widely known to affect, and it's probably one of the more detrimental effects is to the bone health. But there is a lot of other systems that are interplayed with it.
Yeah. So on that then, let's move on to sort of, because if my memory serves me correctly, we used to call it something like the female athlete triad or equivalent. So do you want to just give us a bit of a rundown of what REDS is primarily? And then we can go on to see it sort of talk about how that sort of evolved over time.
Yeah, of course. So REDS is relative energy deficiency in sport. And it's what it says in the tin. It's low of energy availability. So it's an athlete or a dancer or just a recreational exerciser or someone with a high demanding energy requirement job. It's multiple people that can be affected, and it's you're not getting the energy in for the energy out.
Yeah.
So you're unable to give the energy requirements for your training, but also your general day-to-day housekeeping, your general day-to-day physiological processes like breathing, digestion, etc. So I quite like to use the analogy of you've got your phone and it runs out of battery and you can put it on low power saving mode. So it then switches off all its non-essential apps.
Yeah.
Now, this has a detrimental effect to your health and performance because it impacts your hormones. So your hormones go into a disruption. So all your sex hormones will go low. So another quite good analogy is if your body interprets there's not enough food to go around, because essentially you're in starvation mode.
Yeah.
You've not got enough energy to fuel your physiological things that are going throughout the day, then your body's not going to want to produce sex hormones, because why is it going to want to repopulate the earth when there's not enough fuel to go around? So testosterone, estrogen, growth hormone, et cetera, is all going to go down. And that's then going to affect multiple systems. And it's going to just slow down your body's processes. So your bone health will be affected. Your gastrointestinal system's going to slow down. Your metabolic system's going to slow down. Your endocrine system's going to slow down. Cardiovascular function, immune system, so many systems are affected. I mean, it can be intentional. So this is sort of the concept of wanting to lose weight for your sport, which happens, I think, more commonly. But you also have the energy deficit, which isn't intentional. So triathletes, they have a huge training volume. Sometimes they just don't realize how much they need to eat for their training. So it isn't always sort of an intentional thing of I want to lose weight for my sport. It can be unintentional too.
Yeah.
Your body just shuts down, and it impacts both health and performance, and it really does have a detrimental effect.
Yeah, for sure. And I think from my point of view, the change of the name has been quite important to realise that, as you said, the relative energy deficiency part is important rather than just sort of the female part. And my limited knowledge would say, you know, in my sort of knowledge of body processes, it's probably slightly more likely to affect women, or maybe more obviously affect women than it is men. But obviously the same process will affect men as well. So as you said, you know, as soon as you stop eating enough energy to that you're putting out, then you can't run all of those body systems to keep you going, essentially. So something gives out, as you said, you can't produce as much bone density or whatever it is. And I think that name change has sort of brought it more into focus, potentially.
Yeah, I mean, the female athlete triad, if you look at the Red S model, which is on the IOC consensus, it is still part of it, and we can't just disregard it because it has evolved from that. Yeah. But I think as you highlighted, what is important is if you said to a male athlete, oh, you're suffering from the female athlete triad, you know, they're not going to take that very seriously. So number one, it includes males within this continuum because it is important because male athletes very much do suffer from it. Yeah. And it also includes dancers and non-recreational athletes, just your recreational athletes, and it just includes more people. And I also think it highlights the fact that the female athlete triad very much says that it's bone health, as we know now, it affects multiple health systems, but also the fact that it affects performance too. So impaired judgment is going to then affect your power output, your aerobic capacity, multiple systems, because your hormones make you adapt to training. What do people dope with? Like 70% of people dope with hormones. I'm not advocating that, of course, but your hormones is what drives adaptation to your training. So if your hormones are low, you're not going to adapt. So of course your performance is going to be hindered. So that's how it's sort of evolved, the fact that it's including male athletes and the fact that it's including that there are multiple systems affected and the fact that performance is affected too. And also, the if you put the acronym to the female athlete triad, it's FAT, which is rather unfortunate. Yeah. So it's a better terminology, I believe.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And do you think it's something, I don't know whether this is borne out in literature at all, or just your opinion would be interesting. Do you think this is something that is on the increase, or do you just think that we're actually more aware of it now?
I don't think it's necessarily on the increase. I just think the awareness is becoming much better. I know within my sports that it's quite a taboo topic about talking about menstrual status and issues with eating, and it's a very sensitive topic to discuss. And I would only say in the last sort of 2 years, 18 months or so, that athletes have been coming out with their stories, and that's been inspiring other athletes to say that's a problem. I mean, we all know it's very common within our sport. You see that lean athlete turn up on a start line and she'll then run very well for one season, and then all of a sudden she disappears. It happens time and time again, and it's almost been deemed that not having periods is normal.
Yeah.
You know, I would discuss that with some of my training partners, and it wasn't deemed as a big deal, and no one sort of found it to be an issue. So I think now it's just the fact that we're more aware of it, and that not having periods, for example, is now being recognised as it's not right, it's not acceptable.
Yeah, I mean, I've not having experienced those types of conversations, but I've heard other people that work in endurance sports, for example, have said, you know, they've had people or ladies come in who it's almost like a target that then if they're training hard enough that their periods stop, that's how hard they should train. Is that a culture that you've experienced, or is that sort of blown out of proportion a little?
It can be. I mean, I certainly thought that not having periods was a good thing. Why do I want to have to bother with that? It's an inconvenience to training. It is a very much an important thing to be having as a female. I mean, it's your barometer to your hormone health, and we're very lucky as females to have that, whereas men don't have that monthly marker to show that their hormones are healthy. But I certainly agree with you that some people do have that extreme of that, they're training hard enough if their period goes.
Yeah, not ideal.
Not ideal.
No, you wouldn't. I was talking to someone a few weeks ago, and I said, you know, you wouldn't say, oh, I trained so hard my hair fell out.
Yeah.
Like it's sort of the equivalent. It's difficult for me to get my head around for obvious reasons, but I find it's such an extreme view, isn't it? I suppose that it, you know, but when you're so I suppose success focused, and you can see how it happens. You can see it in any sport, how people, like you mentioned before about the obsession, especially with something where you've got such an obvious target of a specific time, or, you know, in team sports, it's more of a, you've just got to beat the team in front of you, or an individual, so you beat the person in front of you. There's not so much that obvious target, whereas, like you said, a marathon, I need to beat 2.5 hours, need to get down my PB or whatever it is. And those marginal gains, for want of a terrible phrase, I can see how those things can add up quite quickly.
I just think it's difficult because some of the personality traits that make these athletes successful are also the personality traits that go to absolute detriment for them. It's a very fine line of being dedicated to training and also being obsessed with training and being an exercise addict. So those personality traits that make us successful are also the ones that I would say highlight someone who'd be at risk of developing Red S or eating disorders. I mean, we know in endurance sports, 20% of people in endurance sports have issues with eating. And that's because we very much have the same personality traits as people that have eating disorders.
Yeah, fair enough, fair enough. And so let's move on to a little bit of a degree. So let's say an endurance athlete comes in to the clinic. Are there any outward signs immediately that you would think? So, I mean, I think we've probably covered a couple already, but so an endurance athlete comes into your clinic and they've got a tendon problem, for example. Is there anything obvious that you would sort of think would trigger you to be thinking about Red S sort of immediately, or is that something that comes out sort of further along the assessment?
I think there's quite a few, on a subjective assessment, I think there's a couple of things we could pick up through that. Mm-hmm. You know, our red flag questions. So, have you had any weight loss? I think not using the term unintentional weight loss, but using weight loss. And they might say that they might have lost a bit of weight. I think it depends of how kind of recognized you are. But I think we should be asking any athlete that's coming in with injuries, you know, are they having periods if they're a female? Mm-hmm. I think personally that should be a red flag question. And that can just slip quite easily into a subjective assessment as part of just our general questioning. So for a female athlete, any amenorrhea, so non-periods, for more than 6 months, I think that's a really big concern. And, you know, just looking at their injury history, you know, have they had multiple bony injuries? Have they had chronic tendon injuries? That there would sort of make me start to wonder. And, you know, you're obviously going to delve into their training history. So, you know, what kind of training volume are they doing? Are they training a lot? Have they got a big training volume? And it's not always a key sign, but, you know, if you have got an athlete with maybe a low BMI, that could be a sign. But you do have athletes with low BMIs that are healthy. And again, you do have athletes with maybe a BMI that you won't expect that would be in a red S state. So that's not always a clear marker. A lot of the other things that you would pick up on, I think, would be more down the line.
Yeah.
I mean, as physios, I think the reason why we are such key people in detecting red S is the fact that we spend quite a lot of time with our patients. You know, when we've got them on the plinth and we're treating, they sometimes feel a little bit disinhibited and we might, you know, confide in us. And we do spend quite a lot of time with them. So it might be over a course of a couple of sessions that we suspect there's an issue and we can start asking maybe more sensitive questions. But I think from a female perspective, the menstrual health is an absolute key. That is our barometer to our hormone health, and I think we should be routinely asking that.
Yeah. Okay. And so let's say let's put a bit more specifics on it. So let's say I had one of my patients not too long ago, and she was still running. She was doing about 35 miles a week.
Yeah.
And she had an Achilles tendinopathy. That's why I was speaking to her. And you know, how would you start to structure the questioning? Because obviously I always liken it a little bit, especially when I'm speaking to them as a man, asking ladies about these types of things. We'll come back to why I'm a bit weird in a minute, but I find it a bit like the low back pain questions when you start to talk about we just had a podcast on corduroy equine syndrome, and suddenly you're asking them about sexual function, etc. And I've got my own little sort of patter that I go through now before I start asking about whether they've had a menstrual cycle recently.
Yeah.
But have you got any advice sort of how to progress through that assessment to, you know, to set that question up? That's how I would do it in low back pain, is I would set that question up. But have you got any advice for especially us as men to try and address that sort of sensitively?
It's a really difficult one to particularly for men to ask, I think. I mean, I'm quite open about it now, but I think it's a lot better to look at it as a training, like a training metric, and just to be really open about it and not to make it a big deal. And I think it just should be included in our subjective and almost like our red flag questions of those awkward questions we have to generally ask anyway with lower back pain. So I think you just have to just bite the bullet and unfortunately just do it. And I think just doing it early on in your first assessment and it, just to make it sound like it's a routine question that you ask everybody, I think that's the only way to go about it. I mean, it is a sensitive question, but I think we do need just to become more open about it. I mean, you know, 50% of the population are females and they're going to be having, should be having periods or would have had some in their life. So we should just be more open about talking about it. And I think it's never going to be an easy question, but it's just changing the culture subtly about it not being a big deal.
Yeah.
And I think if you make a big deal about it, it is a big deal.
Yeah. And I suppose what I do is I tend to put it into my general health questions.
Yeah.
And try to phrase it a bit like that. And you know, I always, I can feel it in myself as I start to stutter over building up to ask that question. And I almost try to put someone at ease, and I do still find it quite difficult.
Yeah.
Although I feel like I'm getting a little bit better at it. So we asked the lady about having a menstrual cycle, and you said not having one in the last 6 months is a real red flag.
Yeah.
Is there any sort of grayer area? So I often say, you know, do you skip any menstrual cycles, or do you find that they're erratic? Just to try and cover my bases, really, because I don't know if I'm confident in knowing what I'm looking for. So now you've given me a 6 months nothing is a big problem. Is there something a bit of a problem in between, or?
I mean, so you've got primary amenorrhea, so that's for your younger athletes. So that's when they have, well, not your younger athletes, it could be your older athletes, but that's not someone who's not had their period by the age of 16. So they could be 25. They could be. So that's when they've just never started a period. You've then got secondary amenorrhea, which is they started their period at a normal age and they've then stopped for more than 6 months. I think in American terminology, they say 3 months.
Right.
But for us in the UK, it's six. In regards to fluctuating periods, that could be a sign that things are starting to maybe go off with an energy deficit perspective. But I think it is also important to understand that amenorrhea might not be due to REDS. And it is very much an exclusion by diagnosis. So REDS is like the last thing to be diagnosed for amenorrhea causes. But it could be other things.
Yeah.
So that's why I think, you know, it is important that we are, if in a case of amenorrhea, we are referring to GPs to exclude other causes. I mean, how do you know that's not a pituitary gland tumor, for example?
Yeah.
Like, we do have to, that's why it's important to exclude it from a red flag perspective. I don't know what it is about amenorrhea and why it's previously been deemed as not a problem, because if any other system stopped working, we'd be really concerned about it. But when it comes to menstrual status, it doesn't seem to, in the past, have caused so much of a red flag or a warning sign. But I think, you know, exclusion by diagnosis is important. So we do need to refer to our GP colleagues to investigate it, regardless of REDS or something else.
I think it's probably easy to fall back on embarrassment, but I bet that's probably where it is. Like you said, if you were training so much your eyesight stopped working, you go to A&E and things like that. Do you know what I mean? I think it probably is an embarrassment. It's got to be a component of it, and plus a lack of understanding as well, probably.
I think it is the lack of understanding and the concept of the culture of, oh, you exercise a lot, you're not going to have periods.
Yeah.
I mean, I certainly know that's been my experience, because I started having amenorrhea at 17, then got some periods again when I had an injury, and then I then got amenorrhea for a very long period of time. But it was never deemed a problem, and I was just told, oh yeah, it's just, you just exercise a lot. I was put on the contraceptive pill for a bit, which again, I'd like to highlight, that is a complete, no-no for treating amenorrhea. You should not be put on the contraceptive pill. And I think that's another thing we should include when asking that question is, you know, are you on the pill? Because that's a withdrawal bleed. That's not a period. So we do need to bear that in mind. Okay. If we have an athlete, we feel a little bit at risk, but they say, oh, I'm on the pill, I'm having periods. Well, they're not having periods because your bone health will not be protected on the contraceptive pill.
Okay. And that's really helpful.
Yeah.
And then, so moving on, the question I actually find harder, which is bizarre, I think it's just my personality, is then going into dietary.
Yes.
Especially when, again, being a man talking to a female, I find it, again, it's not, I don't find it embarrassing. I just don't want to offend people.
Oh, yeah.
When I then start to say, you know, oh, how tall are you? What do you weigh? What do you think of your diet? Have you got any sort of tips for me personally, just stuff the listeners, about how to approach that question specifically?
I think that's the hardest one, to be honest. And they're going to lie.
Well, this is what I think. Yeah, I eat loads.
Okay. Yeah, they're going to... I mean, I remember the first time someone started to ask me was actually a physio. I was 17. I just qualified to run for my county at the English Schools Cross Country Championships, and I had some upper back pain. And I went to see a physio, and I was quite skinny at the time, and I could see them trying to ask the question, and straight away I was very defensive and battered them away. That is what's going to happen. They're not going to be honest with you. So it's just being really, I can't find the words to say it. It's just being quite savvy with your questioning. And I actually think it's better to ask about training.
Yeah.
And try and get their... They're going to want to talk about training because they're going to want to say how much they do. So I think if they're having unhealthy traits with training, they're going to have most likely unhealthy traits of their diet. So using questions just like starting to talk about their training volume, etc., and then saying, oh, if you missed a training session, does that make you feel anxious? And just maybe looking through, talking about their injury history. Oh, did you continue to run through that injury? And just trying to pick up on things like that. And I would probably leave the nutritional questions to maybe when you've built up a bit of a rapport with them, potentially.
Yeah.
But, you know, also just in your subjective, asking them, have they had any nutritional deficiencies? Have they had low vitamin D, B12, low ferritin? Other little signs that might indicate that they've maybe been restrictive of their eating. And just asking, you know, are they vegan? Are they a vegetarian? Are they gluten-free? I think sometimes they can be quite good masking agents for having issues with eating or just maybe being in low energy availability.
Yeah. And I think that reflects on my experience of asking people this and then... Yeah, you're right. Now I think back about it, I get an instant, oh, my eating's fine.
Exactly.
Is there a little bit of... would you say that's almost like a bit of a flag in itself if they are defensive about it or appear defensive about it? It's not something I know a lot about, I must admit. Do you think that might, again, a couple that with the training behaviours, do you think that might be a little bit of a flag we could look at, maybe?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, you just got to try and underpin their attitudes and their potential behaviours. And you do have to be a bit clever about it and pick up your non-verbal skills. And I think with Red S, it's not going to be one... Well, with the periods, that's a killer sign. But generally, it's about putting the pieces together. So if I just use myself as an example, leading up to my England debut... I came off the London Marathon and then I just had this horrific period of time of training. I had two respiratory tract infections I just couldn't get rid of. I wasn't meeting my training targets. I had low iron. I had gastrointestinal problems. And I had a chronic TIB post-tendinopathy. I didn't know at the time about my bone health, but these are all little signs putting together. And then I then had subsequent more weight loss leading into Toronto. So those are all these little things you can put together. Yeah. So it's just putting the pieces together and just using our clinical reasoning and just looking at all the little bits that might add up to your thoughts that this could be a low energy availability issue.
Yeah. So and what I'm hearing is definitely need to ask sort of over the last 6 to 12 months about, like you say, those illnesses as well.
Yeah.
Respiratory tract infections, etc. I think that's something that we don't commonly do, particularly ask about those, because they're relatively little things, aren't they? If you get a cold or whatever, you think you get colds all the time, but as you said, you're mounting up 5, 6, 7 different things. That's not normal. And I think that's a really important a really important thing for us to take on board, I think.
Definitely.
With these people. Yeah, brilliant. Okay, so I wanted to move on a little bit to... You've come into clinic with me, and I think, you know, oh, you've got maybe... this sounds like it might be an energy deficiency problem. Now, obviously, that's not primarily a physio issue. So other than recognition, where would you see the physio's sort of role in the sort of a real acute part? So you recognise, that's job one, you recognise that this might be a problem. What would your immediate sort of suggestions be that we do with this person?
So most of the time when they see us, they're going to be coming in with an injury.
Yeah.
And often, unfortunately, when red S gets diagnosed, it's often with a bony injury. So it's almost like too late by that point. But I think the role of the physio here is, number one, education. So you say, for example, we've got quite clear evidence here that this is a low energy availability issue. It's going to be that education. And if they're coming in with a bony stress injury, we actually are having this key window of opportunity to then deal with it. So you want to sit down with them. You want to say, okay, listen, you've got a bony stress injury. We're going to have to stop training for this anyway and rehab that. But now, why don't we use this as your opportunity to address all these issues? Because realistically, if you're just going to cross train like an animal and you're not going to allow your body to recover from an energy availability perspective and a hormonal perspective, you're going to be back with me with a stress fracture in 6 months. That's the realism of it. Of it. So it's going to be a case of educating, letting them know what red S is. And then it's going to be trying to persuade them that this is an opportunity for them to sort themselves out and to tell them that this is, they don't really care that much about the health complaints. They just want to run fast or perform well. Tell them that, you know, it's going to affect your performance and it's going to affect your health. And, you know, this potential successful running they've been having or whatever sport is now not going to last. And they've got to deal with this. So the education and quite maybe the firm chat of, we've got to deal with this now, is really, really important. The next thing is, I think, onward referral.
Yeah.
This is very much an MDT approach. So getting them into the GP, and this is going to be maybe the more difficult bit, is persuading the GP that X and Y investigations are required. If you have access to a sports medicine doctor, even better.
Yeah.
And I think dietitian and psychologist are absolutely key. To address the energy availability and any psychological overlay that might be happening. I mean, it sounds really simple about dealing with red S, as you train less, you eat more. That's what people have sometimes said to me. Why don't you just go and eat some cake and not train so much? It's not that simple. There's often a big psychological overlay, and it's addressing those behaviours that have maybe been going on for quite a lot of time,
yeah.
And those beliefs that they might have. And, you know, a lot of that's going to be part of their personality. And we don't necessarily want to change that. But I think psychological counselling or seeing a psychologist or whoever, it is really an important part. And I think that should not be dismissed, because, you know, we've got to recognise our scope of practice here. So I certainly think dietitian, psychologist and GP at the very least is essential.
Yeah, I can sort of see a situation as well where you're a new person coming into this athlete's existence, and they've been told or it's been accepted that these problems they've been having are normal, and this amount of eating and training is normal, and you're coming in out of the blue almost and saying, no, that's wrong. I can see some pushback from, you're new, what do you know? You don't know me. So I can see, obviously the MDT approach is important for those other reasons you mentioned, but I can also see that having multiple people saying that, especially someone like an SEM doc
who's
got that obvious, they're an obvious authority figure, which sounds a horrible thing to say over us as physios, but they're an obvious authority situation is going to be super helpful, like you said, because of that psychological element.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's getting our patients on board with the issue and that what they're doing long term is not going to make them a better athlete. And just making them aware of the detrimental effects that it's having. And then again, you know, it's going to be careful communication with the coach as well. I mean, generally coaches are pretty on board with what we do, but it's getting the coach on board with that too. So it's almost that they have no avenue of escape or no avenue of saying, oh, this person says I can do this. And it's getting everyone on board with the treatment plan and everyone's singing off the same hymn sheet. Because the type of personality these people are, they're going to be very good at trying to undermine everything that we do. I have done it. So, you know, you do a strength and conditioning session. You say you do this, but they'll make it into a cardio session. That's what's going to happen. So it's been very prescriptive with that. I mean, another thing what we have, I have over the referrals to the appropriate members of the team is essential, but they're going to be coming in with an injury. We need to deal with that injury. And we can have quite an influence on the training aspect of what they're doing. So we know that with Reds, it's going to be reducing the training volume so that we can restore the energy deficit and get things in balance. So this is why we have to work very closely with the dietitian, is that we know they're eating enough for their rehab, because we're going to have to rehab them at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So from our perspective here, it's going to be working closely with our dietitian colleagues, and it's being very prescriptive with what they're allowed to do. So it'll be, okay, we're trying to build up a bit of aerobic fitness. We can now transfer doing a bit of cross training. This has to be like zone 1-2. Set them a heart rate parameter. And that will coincide with their coach, of course. And then with their strength and conditioning, having a really careful plan. And eventually you're going to want to start to do some sort of impact activity, which is essential for bone health. Particularly if you've got a sport like cycling, where they're pretty much non-weight bearing the whole time, which is awful for their bones anyway. You need some activity that's going to have that osteogenic response.
And I suppose they're the type, again, going back to their psychological profile, the kind of people that we're working with will actually respond to that quite nicely, because they're used to working in heart rate zones. Like you said, you had pace timings and mile timings and all this kind of thing. And I think, would you say, it's not my area of expertise, but I struggle to see that many scenarios where I would be involved specifically with rehabbing someone with REDS. But, you know, are there any resources where you would point listeners to specifically that would say, you know, here is a good model for building that training program up? Or would you just say, you know, if you're not that experienced, actually it's worth sending someone to a specialist physio that works with an SEM doc? Or, you know, some people might not have that option, I suppose.
I think it depends on the athlete's injury, because obviously we're going to treat the injury regardless. Yeah. So we do need to treat that injury. So if it's Achilles tendinopathy, we need to do that anyway. But if it's low bone density, you might then want to be a bit more prescriptive and read up on the area. I've just written a blog, actually, for the BJSM blog about rehab for REDS and low bone density and stress fractures.
Perfect.
So I think that might be coming out today or tomorrow.
Brilliant. We can link that.
Yeah, so it basically talks all about the impact exercises. Yep. It talks about the evidence for strength and conditioning and osteoporosis, and about more, which probably comes under what we have to maybe talk to the coach or speak to an SEM doctor about, but about just training in general. So it's the intensity training which tends to be the issue, and the high volume of the cardio. So just being careful with that. So when we say, okay, we'll give you the green light to start cross training, it's low intensity.
Yeah.
And when we give them the green light to start, for example, return to run program, that they're doing 1 minute run, 1 minute walk, but they're not sprinting the 1 minute run, and that they're doing it as a jog.
Yeah.
And it's just making sure they're not, your athlete's not cheating, because they will try very hard.
I can imagine. Yeah. I can imagine. Especially once they've been kept out of running for a while and they're allowed to go back, they will push it.
So you've got to put them on the reins a little bit, and that's that close communication with the coach and the dietitian as well, to making sure that as the rehab increases or their training increases, that we're still in that energy requirement. Because psychologically they're going to be happy to push on their training always, but they might not psychologically be there yet with the eating. So until that they're on par and that everything's level, we can't push the training up until they're psychologically happy with their eating.
Yeah, fair enough. And on a similar topic but slightly different, is there a role for physio in sort of mitigating the risk of someone developing REDS? So let's say you've got someone who does a lot of mileage,
yes,
and they've come in with an Achilles tendinopathy, but actually they don't really trigger you any, there's no sort of flags, they're their periods are fine. They seem their BMI is not low or anything like that. But they're on a, they're talking about their building, they're running up and they're doing more mileage or they're getting faster. Would you bring in any education at that point to the athlete to say, you know, this could be a risk? Or is that just sort of setting a fire under something that we maybe shouldn't necessarily worry about at that point?
I certainly think prevention is better than cure. I think we should all be quite aware of the health issues regarding to low energy availability, because it's very easy to fall into that. I think it's just maybe looking at the personality traits of that patient potentially and just seeing if they kind of tick any of your flags of, are they going to be someone who's going to be a bit obsessive overtraining? They could be a new runner, for example, yeah. And they might have obsessive traits elsewhere in their life, and that might then escalate into their running, and they'll be fine initially, and then later on it could be a problem. So it's just picking up on those subtle personality traits and then certainly providing education. It doesn't have to be a lot, but just making sure they're aware that, you know, cutting corners of their training, running loads, not eating enough, race weight, etc. That's not going to be a long-term success. Mm. And just promoting about longevity in the sports and just making sure they're not doing any training errors. I mean, we're going to have to cover training errors of an Achilles tendinopathy anyway. So just making sure that we're maybe delving into a little bit about the energy availability there too.
Yeah, perfect. Okay, no worries. Taking it back a little bit again, so slightly different approach this time. So your athlete comes in and speaks to you. They've got their energy deficiencies. Do you think REDS is a possibility? So certainly in my role, I've got the availability of scanning people. I don't have bloods at the moment, but you know, some physios have access to blood results, etc. Would you say there's any role at that stage of doing any of those investigations, or would you say, you know, an SEM doc actually is probably the best place to go?
I mean, I do think an SEM doc is ideal, okay, of course. But your athlete might not have the finances to do that. They might not have private medical cover, or they just might not be available. But you can certainly get a lot of bloods just done on the NHS. That will be really insightful, a GP can do.
Yeah.
I mean, I think a really interesting stat is with looking at hormonal health and the risk of stress fractures, it's more shocking in men, unbelievably. So with men, with low testosterone, the incidence of stress fractures go up sevenfold. So I think it goes from 4% to 60% risk.
Wow. Yeah.
It's huge. And with females, it's less. But males are really, really at risk. So we know that if there's low hormones, your bone health is so affected. So you can pretty much guarantee if someone's coming in with a bone stress injury, it's a very high incidence that there's going to be a hormonal disruption there.
Yeah.
So in regards to blood markers, there's a lot that you can get on the NHS. And type of ones that I would recommend getting is your hormonal profile.
Right.
So that would be your estradiol. FSH, LH, testosterone for men, and then also your thyroid function, because your thyroid gets affected. So just THS is quite useful. Other things you want to look at, just a full blood count. They might have some anemia, just looking at the just general health status. Vitamin D, important for bone health. We know that's definitely have bone health problems if you've got low vitamin D. B12, ferritin's a really big one. And then if, for example, they have a bit more money resources or they have private medical cover, really good markers is leptin,
right,
and IGF-1, and then looking at T3, which is another thyroid measure, which is a little bit more specific, but that's not in the NHS. But I know private blood testing is very readily available with stuff like Medichecks, etc. So
yeah.
I think bloods are a really useful marker. And also I think athletes sometimes need to see something, an objective marker about what's going on. They might not quite believe that they've got low testosterone or low estrogen, and sometimes they actually need to see it, so it can be quite helpful. I mean, in regards to if you've got someone with a stress fracture, one or more, and you know they're amenorrheic or that you've seen they've got low testosterone, I would think that DEXA scanning is quite important. And for me, from a personal perspective, that it was that which really made me thought, oh God, what am I doing? And you know, you open up a paper a results paper and it says, you know, osteopenia, and then you look at your L3, which is nearly osteoporotic, you know, that is quite a shocking thing to see. And I think that can sometimes really wake people up to the health consequences that you're doing. And then, of course, if we're suspecting a bony injury, we need to scan that.
On the DEXA scanning, I think that's a relatively available thing for us to request. Would you advocate, what would be your cutoff to send someone for a DEXA scan? Would you wait for someone to have those outward signs of energy deficiency, like the amenorrhea, or would you preempt that even with someone who, like we said, someone with the personality type, they might have been running for a few years, but you think they're a bit on that sort of spectrum of personality, but they haven't actually got any of those necessary outward signs, but maybe their BMI is quite low. Would you advocate DEXA scanning at that point, or again, do you think that's slightly overkill?
I think it just depends. I think a good marker that we can, objective marker tool we can use, which can maybe help guide if we need to be scanning in that sense, is the REDS CAT. So it's a clinical assessment tool, which basically traffic light systems are athletes. So you have your red light, and that's, you need to stop people from training. They're dangerous. They're someone with, you know, quite significant eating disorders, ones that have potentially cardiovascular issues, so extreme bradycardia, stuff like that. They're your ill people that you need to stop training because it's going to be absolute detriment to their health. You've then got your orange zone, which is going to be the people that we're concerned about. I think that orange zone is probably the ones that are worth DEXA scanning.
Yeah.
So that's going to be somebody that displays disordered eating, that they've had one or more stress fractures, they've had amenorrhea for more than 6 months, those type of people. And we deem, once we've scanned them, we use the this population Z score, not T score, because it compares to their age, not to sort of the general population.
Yeah.
And it's having a Z score of less than -1. I think, is that what it is? Less than -1?
Sounds right to me.
Yes, less than -1. So that's a cause for concern.
Yeah.
And that's when we might want to start certainly referring to someone for treatment for that, in regards to potentially having medical treatment for that, so some pharmacological input.
Cool. No, that sounds good. So that was the REDS CAT.
REDS CAT. So REDS CAT. Yes, it's on the IOC consensus.
Lovely.
Which is the big paper, Margot Mountjoy. We can put a link in.
We can link to that. Perfect, great. So not too much left to speak about, really. We talked about sort of some resources in that. Are there any online sort of educational resources, again, that you would direct the patient to? So again, you find a lot of people, especially if you're new to them, who talk about how much information they actually take on board during an appointment. So anything you would point people to, sort of to the patients? Any resources there?
Yeah, definitely. So Dr. Nikki Key has been, she's a sports endocrinologist, has been doing a lot of great work with Basim. So she has developed a brilliant website called healthforperformance.co.uk, and that has resources for athletes, for parents, for coaches, for healthcare professionals. And she writes a lot of really great blogs for BGSM and on her own website as well. Her Twitter's really good to follow for anyone. So she's at Nikki Key Fitness, and she's been doing quite a lot of research as well, particularly in cyclists, and has been finding some really interesting information. So she's created that website, and it's brilliant. All the resources you want, all links to blogs. So it's good for everyone to read.
Brilliant.
I'd also recommend trainbrave.org, which is a campaign to raise awareness of REDS and eating disorders in sports. Again, that has a lot of great information, a lot of personal blogs of athletes that have gone through it, and I think that's quite helpful for our patients to read someone who's gone through it, because they can often resonate with that, and they can say, oh, that is literally what's happening to me. And I think that's quite important, is to read what other people have gone through, and it can kind of make them think, okay, that is me. There are also some quite exciting clinics now happening for specifically for REDS. So there is one which is based at the National Orthopaedic Hospital in London. And it's actually for dancers, but they do take on athletes as well. So it's the National Institute of Dance Medicine and Science, and that is NIDMS.co.uk. And that is an NHS clinic, and they will be able to do all the bloods that you need, DEXA scan, etc. And there's also a clinic called Inspire, which is done by Nikki, and then a dietitian called Rini McGregor, who's quite well known within the Reds field. So they have a clinic, which I think is based in Bath at the moment. Brilliant. So there's lots of resources coming out, but I think the go-to one for me would be healthforperformance.co.uk.
Yeah, perfect. Brilliant. And any resources personally for you? Obviously, we'll link to your BGSM blog, but anything that you're doing, anything that's coming up? There's no point linking to what you're talking about today because everyone will have missed it. But anything else that you've got?
I haven't got anything coming at the moment, but I know Train Brave have a lot of seminars that are free all around the country. They're doing a lot more. I think there's one in Durham coming up potentially this weekend very soon. And I think there's good to be another one up north, potentially Manchester. So I'd go on the trainbrave.org website and look for some of their talks they're doing because they're great. And Nikki is brilliant. She's so informative. And occasionally I do go and speak at them. I've spoken at a couple of them before. So, yeah.
Excellent. Really good. Well, I want to thank you for taking your time out of the show today to come and speak to us. I think it's going to be a really useful podcast. I've learned loads that I can apply. And I think personally I need to ask those questions more often. My specialty being rheumatology, I always say, you know, when I run courses that if you're not referring people and they're coming back negative, you're missing people.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Because if you only ever got a positive result, then surely you're missing people. Because there must be people with symptoms. Like you said, it could be something else masquerading, for example.
Exactly.
So, you know, I think personally, I need to ask more often and be braver about asking about
for
diet.
Sure.
And recognize the personality traits, I think, is something that I need to get
definitely
better at.
And we're the gateway to healthcare often. First point of call is often a physio, and we can be that gateway to accessing, you know, GPs, sports medicine doctors. So we're such a key person in the recognition of Red S. So it's something I'm really passionate about highlighting to my colleagues about.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you very much.
No worries.
Well, I think you'll agree with me. That is a really useful podcast. Certainly loads of information within there. It's going to take me a few listens back to get everything that I need out of it. But it's certainly changed my practice already. It's increased my vigilance to the signs and symptoms of this condition. And maybe more importantly, the way that I frame those questions. Hopefully also understanding the nuance better within the answers that are provided. Please get in touch with any feedback with regards to the show. You can email us, physiomatters@choosehealth.co.uk. I'm sure Anna will be happy to answer any of your questions, so please find her on Twitter at Anna Boniface and the Physio Matters team at TPM Podcast, and of course myself at Physio Jack. I'd be completely insane if I didn't take this little chance to plug my own Recognising Rheumatology course. Tickets are now available at the Choose Health headquarters in Timperley in December. You can find further information on that and how to book tickets at rheumatology.physio/courses. And if you sign up, of course, we'll give you a tour of the Physio Matters studio. What more could you ask for? We will be back in a couple of weeks' time with Adrian's Patient Matters recording. And then session 67 next month will be with no other than the great Peter Malieras. So we are super excited about the record for that one. Finally, I leave you with Anna giving us the cheesy sign out. Thank you for listening and we'll see you next time.
You've been listening to the Physio Matters podcast, discussing physio matters because physio matters.